Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Today's business travelers are finding that fitting in a little leisure time keeps them recharged and excited on work trips. I know this because whenever I travel for work, I always try and meet up with a friend to catch up, have a great dinner, or hit a museum wherever I am. So if you're traveling for work, go with the card that puts the travel in business travel, the Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card. If you travel, you know. The spirit of performance is what defines Acura, and now it's electric, introducing the ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com. Hey, everyone. Want to grow your business faster and stronger? Wondering how to find and keep top talent? Well, it starts with your company culture. Your company's identity and operations depend on the culture you create. Fortunately, there's Insperity, a leading HR provider. Their specialists show you how to build a culture aligned with your business goals, driving success. Download their free ebook, The Future of Business is Culture, at Insperity.com for ways to create a culture that fuels growth. With the right people, processes, and values in place, your company can realize its full potential. Visit Insperity.com to see how Insperity provides HR that makes a difference. Hey, welcome to How I Built This Lab. I'm Guy Raz. So imagine getting on a jet in New York and arriving in Paris just 3 hours later. Well, for a long time, that was possible. From the mid-70s to the early 2000s, the Concorde made the dream of supersonic commercial flight a reality. It would whisk passengers across oceans in half the time it takes today. The problem was it was really, really expensive. It takes a ton of fuel to fly that fast. And the planes had to be so skinny and aerodynamic that they couldn't carry as many passengers as a typical airliner. And so the Concorde just didn't make economic sense. Now, it's been 20 years since the last commercial supersonic flight happened in 2003. But today's guest, Blake Scholl, hopes to change that. His company, Boom Supersonic, is designing a new generation of supersonic airplanes for commercial flight. And they've announced partnerships with several major airlines who hope to have those planes flying with passengers by the end of this decade. Growing up in Ohio, Blake was one of those kids who was obsessed with airplanes. He loved to draw pictures of them, he loved to watch them fly, and he would dream about building them. As a teenager, that fascination gave way to an interest in computers and other technologies, leading to an early career as a software engineer at Amazon.
I remember my first meeting with Bezos was when I was 22.
Wow.
And it was... My boss's boss had told me, hey, Jeff has strong opinions about this project you're about to start, and you should go meet him and listen to him and earn his trust so he doesn't micromanage your stuff. Huh. And so I was 22. I was nervous as all get out. This was right when the Segway had come out, if we can remember that
thing. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And Amazon back then was the exclusive retailer for the Segway. And so it's 5 o'clock on a Friday, me and my direct manager and the CEO of the company.
Wow.
And Jeff walks in and he's like, hey, guys, want to ride my Segway? And we spent the first 30 minutes of that meeting just going up and down the halls of Amazon headquarters on Jeff's Segway.
Yeah. That sounds fun.
Oh, it was a total blast. I can't imagine a better icebreaker that got me to calm down and be able to really engage with him.
So you ended up working at Amazon for 5 years and left in 2006 to go to a startup called Pelago, which I guess was like a kind of early social media mobile app.
It was, think of it as Yelp plus Google Maps plus Foursquare on a Motorola Razr. In 2006.
I'm already overwhelmed. Too much information. I don't think I could handle all that.
That was exactly the story of the failure of that product. You nailed it. I think one of the mistakes we made at Pelago was trying to build a product that had all the maturity of what Amazon was after a decade on day one, and it was overwhelming to develop, and it was overwhelming for customers. And you know, there were so many good ideas. Had we just picked one, it could have been a massive success, but we tried to do too many.
Right. I had a Razor myself. I kind of miss it now because I look at my smartphone too much. I wish I had the Razor, just answer calls and send texts.
It's a simpler time.
Simpler times. All right. From what I understand, this is around the time while you were there at this company, Pelago, that you kind of really got interested in flying.
Well, I started flying for fun a few years earlier when I was in college. I remember in high school, a classmate was getting flying lessons, and I remember being really jealous. And I was like, man, I want to go do that. And when I did one of my internships in college, and I was like one exit down the highway in the San Francisco Bay Area from a little airport. And I'm like, wait a minute, I can get flying lessons. And so I think I got like 10 hours of flying lessons, something like that. And I didn't come back to it until kind of the time period we were talking about when I was at Pelago and started, you know, to finish my pilot's license and kind of just got more interested in how airplanes work. And that was about the time period where I set a lifetime goal of flying supersonic.
Yeah. All right, so you got your pilot's license and you're working at this startup, which you eventually leave, and you start up your own startup called Kima Labs, which was, I guess, it was an app with like a barcode and mobile payment services. What? Tell me about Kima Labs.
To be honest about it, it was not really a success. We started with what I thought I was good at, rather than what I thought should exist in the world. And so I'm like, hey, I know e-commerce from Amazon.
Yeah.
And I know mobile social from my time at Pelago. So what should I do? I should do mobile e-commerce because, like, surely that's going to be a thing.
Yeah.
But I've come to believe that's actually a backwards way to think about it because skills and knowledge are highly variable. Like, you can learn new things, but passion is a lot less variable. And so I went where I thought I knew stuff rather than trying to build something that I really wanted to exist in the world. Hmm. And so the main thing we built was this thing called Barcode Hero that was kind of a barcode scanning game. And then when you're shopping in a store, you could go scan a barcode and it would like pull up all the other content that people would put in and help you figure out like, you know, what headphones you want to buy or whatnot.
Right. Well, you did end up selling the company. It was acquired by Groupon, obviously a famous sort of, I don't know if cautionary tale is totally fair, but I mean, it was a massive unicorn. It went public. It was valued like $30 billion at one point, and then, you know, just declined in its value quickly as people realized you could replicate the model. I think at one point, like Google maybe had offered to buy Groupon, which they did not accept. So you were there when all this was happening, when it was like kind of in a little bit of free fall, I think.
In a way, I mean, my synthesis of Groupon is it's a story of massively lost potential. In my view, that company had all the potential to be worth $30 or $100 billion and really to have earned it. But they made kind of one critical mistake, which was taking the company public before they were operationally ready to do it. Not because the business was in free fall, but for just dumb reasons. Like the right data wasn't in the accounting system. And so it was just really stumbling over their own internal ability. And then so what happens is now they're missing earnings and they're missing earnings and they're missing earnings. And there's pressure from Wall Street. The visionary CEO got fired.
Yeah, that's Andrew Mason, right?
That's Andrew Mason, yeah. And what Groupon, I think, could have been, there's so many pitches I've heard in local commerce that require solving a chicken and egg problem. You have to have a digital connection to the consumer and a digital connection to the merchant, and that's very hard to bootstrap. But Groupon, with the digital coupon thing, figured out how to bootstrap it. They had a massive collection of chickens and eggs, and Andrew Mason had a really compelling vision to turn that into something amazing. Like imagine you could book a reservation on your phone. And when you book the reservation, it says, hey, you know, would you like a picture of margaritas and calamari on the table when you get there? And you say, yes, obviously. And then, you know, the digital connection would go all the way into the back end of the restaurant. So when your reservation is coming up, you know, the bartender starts making your drinks and the kitchen starts firing the calamari. You show up, it lands on the table as you sit down. And then, you know, when you're done with your meal, you get up and leave and it just builds your Groupon account. And that's an experience that like still doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And Groupon has sort of collected all the sort of key infrastructure pieces to make this a reality. They kind of bought my company for some of the pieces and we went and we bought another point of sale company to do this.
Yeah.
And then Andrew got fired And the focus really shifted on, well, we just got to focus on the next quarter.
Yeah.
And then the business became what it's caricatured for, which is this not differentiated internet coupon business. But yeah. Like, boy, it's missed potential.
Yeah. I noticed on your LinkedIn page, it says 2012, 2014 works at Groupon, and you write, right under it, there's nothing like working on internet coupons to make you yearn to build something you truly love. Which you know, is a bit of a chuckle. And Groupon, obviously, a smart company and offered an interesting product, but that wasn't really where your heart was. And I wonder when you know, when your previous company was acquired by Groupon, obviously you make a commitment to stay with the acquiring company oftentimes. But were you already at that point thinking about something in aviation?
Yes and no. I had this thing on my to-do list that had been on there for years called Figure Out How to Start an Aviation Company.
Huh.
And I ordered some books to read, some textbooks on airplane design. And honestly, I did nothing with it. It sat there on my to-do list with nothing but books ordered that were sitting collecting dust on my bookshelf.
Yeah.
So I knew in the back of my mind that kind of one day I would love to find a way to intersect my career with flight, because I was so passionate about it. And I also knew that there was just so much that was broken in air travel. Like I would get on an airplane, and just as a thought experiment, I would say, man, what would this thing be like if Steve Jobs and Johnny Ive had designed it?
Yeah, it would be awesome.
It'd be totally awesome. But just even asking that question makes it so much easier to see just how bad it really is today and how much opportunity there is. And so all this was sort of rattling around the back of my head, but I wasn't, at that point in my life, I wasn't doing anything with it.
Yeah. I mean, air travel is a miracle. You know, you're up in a metal tube flying across the country or the world, and it is incredible. But that technology, I mean, jet travel hasn't changed, right? It hasn't changed in 50 years. It's basically been updated, made more efficient and modernized, but it's the same basic principle. You know, there's a jet engine, you get in the plane, and then it takes off and you land, and that's it.
That's right. I mean, I find it very paradoxical because on one hand, it is this amazing thing that it exists. I mean, we take off on the runway accelerating to hundreds of miles per hour, climbing into the sky in near perfect safety. We get to look down at that view that, you know, humans were not born to have, that frankly no bird can have, where we get to take in all the natural beauty of our world as well as what, you know, we as humanity have created. And that singular vantage point provided by the airplane is this amazing, very visceral manifestation of what humanity has accomplished. And, and yet, on the other hand, like you said, it hasn't gotten any better in half a century. And in fact, it's gotten worse in a lot of ways. And so in my mind, it represents both the pinnacle of human achievement, but also this very weird thing where we've stopped and gone backwards.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about innovation, you know, we've had both Herb Kelleher, the founder of Southwest Airlines, and David Neeleman of JetBlue on the show in the past. And they were both true innovators, right? I mean, not necessarily around aircraft technology, but around how to make air travel cheaper and more accessible and more efficient. I mean, the main thing that's changed in the last 50 years is that more people can fly because it's cheaper, right? You can pack more people in and it's more efficient, but it's certainly not a pleasant experience to fly on a commercial airplane today.
No, I mean, we've turned something that in my view, people should be incredibly inspired by and look forward to into an experience that most of us dread. Mm. And, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. It's solvable. But you were talking about how, you know, Herb and Dave Neeleman, and there have been others who have been great innovators in making travel more accessible, more affordable. You know, they've both innovated with experience. But if you look at the history of entrepreneurship and aviation broadly, there was kind of a first era starting from the Wright brothers and going until the 1960s where there were entrepreneurs focused on the airplanes themselves. Mm. And then in the 1960s, basically all the entrepreneurs in the aircraft companies retired.
Mm.
And if we look at that entire now more than 100-year history of aviation, I think it shows a really interesting pattern that I bet we could find in other industries as well, which is founder-led companies tend to push what the product can do.
Yeah.
And then when the founders retire, what happens in those companies? Well, they promote the most successful executive.
right,
that reported to them, who by definition is really different than the founder because they had to compliment the founder.
Yeah.
And so what do? They go in optimization mode. And so if you look at all commercial aviation over the last half century, what have we done? We've optimized. Like, Google a picture of Boeing's first airliner, the 707, and put that right next to a picture of the 787. And if you're not an airplane nerd, it's actually kind of hard to spot the differences.
Yeah.
It's optimized. It's a much better, more efficient, safer machine that does exactly the same job, but it hasn't gotten better at what job it can do.
We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back in just a moment, more from Blake Scholl, founder and CEO of Boom Supersonic. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This Lab. Successful companies don't happen overnight. It takes an awful lot of grit, determination, and teamwork. Our sponsor, Atlassian, knows this better than anyone. Their team has spent over 20 years creating software that powers collaboration for teams around the world. By creating software like Jira and Confluence to improve companies' workflow, Atlassian is on a mission to make impossibility a reality. And now, they're ushering in the next era of teamwork with Atlassian Intelligence. When you think of AI, pizza may not be the first thing that comes to mind. But global pizza chains are actually using AI to scan their pies and make sure they meet their quality standards. From space exploration to making pizza to producing podcasts like the one you're listening to right now, Atlassian thinks there's a lot about AI that companies should be excited about. Atlassian Intelligence transforms teamwork by empowering AI-human collaboration. Atlassian's AI-powered software can help you glean new insights from your data, boost individual productivity by eliminating menial tasks, and help your team make faster, more informed decisions to produce the best results for your customers. And the best part? With Atlassian Intelligence in your corner, you can trust that your work is protected and kept confidential. This isn't just a small step. It's a giant leap in accelerating work. Atlassian AI-powered software like Jira and Confluence help teams accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually, we're great, but together, we're so much better. Learn how Atlassian AI can help power high-performing teams at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian. As a business-to-business marketer, your needs are unique. B2B buying cycles are long, and your customers face incredibly complex decisions. Isn't it time you had a marketing platform built specifically for you? LinkedIn Ads empowers marketers with solutions for you and your customers. LinkedIn Ads allow you to build the right relationships, drive results, and reach your customers in a respectful environment. You'll be able to drive results with targeting and measurement tools built specifically for B2B. In technology, LinkedIn generated 2 to 5 times higher return on ad spend than other social media platforms. I've talked to hundreds of founders and business leaders every day on this show, and I've learned that LinkedIn has been vital to the growth of their companies. It helps them build relationships with customers and get direct access to thousands of decision makers. Make B2B marketing everything it can be and get a $100 credit on your next campaign. Go to linkedin.com/builtthis to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/builtthis. Terms and conditions apply. When your work presentations and docs look good, you look good. Design stunning work presentations, docs, whiteboards, and videos with Canva. Canva is an easy-to-use online design platform that helps people at work design compelling visual content. We're all looking for ways to make an impact at work. Canva helps you get your point across visually. It's easy to design impactful Canva presentations, docs, whiteboards, and videos. Start with a designer-made template and customize your content. Add images, graphics, charts, and more from the massive media library. Canva makes it easy to wow any audience. I know so many companies and organizations that use Canva to do client pitch decks, stakeholder presentations, and slides for team meetings every single day. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work. Welcome back to How I Built This Lab. I'm talking with Blake Scholl, CEO and founder of Boom Supersonic. All right, let's talk about what you do now. You decided to start an aviation company, and not just any company, but one that is going to revive supersonic flight, which, I mean, unless you're in the military, I think the last opportunity to fly faster than the speed of sound would have been on the Concorde, which was put out of service in 2003. How did you come to the decision to start such an ambitious project like this?
In a sort of roundabout way, I started out thinking I would convince myself to not start it. I wanted to work on a new startup. I realized that no matter what startup I founded, I would work really hard at it, and I would be sort of at my personal red line, regardless of what I'm doing. And so I wanted to pick something that would be very much the opposite of my first company, where I would never get up in the morning and think, why in the world did I get into this? Mm. And so I kind of took a deep breath and said, okay, I got to look at this supersonic thing. And I thought I would get 2 weeks into the research and understand why nobody was doing it, and then move on to something that was, you know, less pie in the sky. But instead, what I found was a bunch of stale conventional wisdom. You know, there were zillions of, you know, articles and YouTube videos out there that purported to explain why airplanes didn't fly faster. And one of the themes was, it was always a qualitative answer to a quantitative question. Mm. And so people would say things like, speed inherently has to cost more.
Yeah.
And if you can't fly supersonic over land, the market's not big enough.
Right.
And people won't pay for speed. But you know, hang on, those are all qualitative statements about quantitative phenomenon. You know, like, okay, people clearly do pay for speed. It's why direct flights are preferred over connecting flights.
Yeah.
And, you know, okay, speed is going to come with some kind of a, you know, increased fuel burn because physics, but okay, how much? And how does that relate to all these other factors? And how might it be improved? And okay, there's some constraints on where you can fly supersonic. With those constraints, how big is the market? Mm-hmm. And so I started building models of what, you know, the airplane ought to be capable of.
Yeah.
And, you know, downloaded a whole bunch of like global air travel data and started crunching it to say, okay, well, how much of this could benefit from supersonic? And, you know, by the middle of 2014, I had two things that were just like really shocking. One was sort of a very simple model of the airplane, which said that we should be able to make a supersonic airplane that would be profitable at business class fares. And also this market model that said, even with the constraints on being able to fly supersonic over oceans but not over populated areas, such a machine would have a very large market, just taking people who are flying first or business internationally today and letting them get there in half the time at the same price points.
Wow.
And so at that point, I was like, I don't understand why no one's doing this. And I took both of those things to a professor at Stanford who had done a bunch of supersonics research. And I was like, dude, can you look at this and check my math? Because I cannot possibly be the human that was the first one to build this model.
Yeah.
Like, that's not my self-concept. And I've been in aviation for like a hot second with no background, really. And he looks at it and he's like, Blake, if you're going to do this, you should really try harder because a bunch of your assumptions are conservative.
Wow.
And I remember walking out of his office and thinking, this comes down to courage. Like, when I look in the mirror, I have a hard time seeing myself as like, oh yeah, I'm the guy who created supersonic flight in a mainstream way. Like, that just, like, that just the ego in that statement is insane. But it seems like there's a possibility here, and I could either be scared of it and run from it, or I could say, I'm just going to give everything I've got and find out what I'm capable of.
Wow. So basically, this technology, right, the Concorde that was kind of put out to pasture in 2003, that was it. I mean, the story was, yeah, it didn't quite work. It was too expensive. It was inefficient, you know, not good for the environment, and it just didn't make sense. But when you started crunching numbers, particularly transatlantic business class flights, you saw that essentially you could make a much more efficient plane in 2014 than you could in 2003. You started to put this puzzle together and you came to the conclusion that this actually can be done. You can actually build a faster plane, more efficient, and it could actually be profitable.
I mean, that's right. But in a way, it was easier than that because it wasn't 2014 versus 2003. It was 2014 versus 1962.
Right.
So, I mean, imagine if we'd stopped innovating in computers at the time of the UNIVAC.
Yeah.
And all we did is make them more efficient, but they were still kind of mainframes.
Yeah.
And then someone pops up and says, could we have an iPhone?
right.
But yet somehow all the component technology had evolved. Then actually, oh, you could create the iPhone, and that's what was going on in aviation. Like all the component technology did progress impressively, so, but nobody had put it together into a product with a different capability.
Yeah. All right. So you are not a mechanical engineer. You're obviously a smart guy, and you're an engineer. But you know, like RJ Scaringe, the founder of Rivian, you know, he's a PhD in mechanical engineering. He wanted to build cars his whole life. Elon Musk is not a mechanical engineer. He runs a car company. But so there are obviously examples of this. But I have to imagine that one of the first things you have to do is find somebody to work with you. Is that what you did?
That was really the second thing, not the first thing. The first thing was really to just get educated myself.
Yeah.
And I remember doing this exercise where I said, okay, Blake, just imagine the year is 2050 and you're sitting on the beach, sipping Mai Tais, reading about how the world made the leap to supersonic. I mean, and first off, it's hard to imagine that it didn't. Like, it'd be really, really weird if, like, aviation just, like, permanently got stuck at 85% of the speed of sound and nobody ever broke through.
Yeah.
So, okay, so someone's going to break through. What does that story look like? You know, is it after, you know, a century of not doing it, Boeing or Airbus does it? No, that's not really how these things go in history. Okay, so it's probably a startup. And then I just started to imagine, what would the story of that startup have to look like? They have to put together a dream team. Because this is hard to do, and it's going to need the very best people. So ability to attract and retain great people is going to be fundamental to the success. And you know, and it's going to require a leader that deeply understands all the key pieces of the business, including the technology down to the physics.
Right.
And so I look in the mirror and I'm like, I am currently not any of those things.
So you had to become that.
I had to become it. And it was like, okay, Blake, I have a very flexible concept of who you are. Your only shot at this is to morph yourself into the leader that this thing needs.
Hmm.
And as I started recruiting, my favorite interview question was, teach me something.
Mm.
And so along the way, I learned a lot from those conversations and started hiring people who both deeply understood the technology of what they were doing all the way down to first principles physics and were also great communicators. And I think that those two things were really at the core of the early boom team and explain why we've been able to get as far with this as we have.
Yeah. All right. Let's just talk about how you actually build an airplane. I mean, where do you go? I mean, you had to build a prototype of a supersonic aircraft. It's not like, you know, we've had a lot of cosmetics companies on the show. It's not like going to a white label cosmetics plant and going, hey, build me this. Here's the 20 ingredients that I want in there and just come back to me in a month. Like, where do you start?
Well, we started off with what the design was. And so it started off very digitally focused. And we actually put a lot of attention on how we develop the airplane, not just actually going off and building something. So great software is loosely coupled. Like one piece of our code, if we change it, shouldn't affect what another piece of our code does. But great airplanes are very tightly coupled, highly integrated machines. The best wing structurally is thick. The best wing aerodynamically is thin. If we add more passengers, then all of a sudden the whole airplane has to get bigger. The wing has to get stronger. The engines need more thrust, needs to carry more fuel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so for that reason, airplane design tends to be highly iterative. And historically, when design is very manual, the pace of iteration is slow. And so one of the early insights was that we wanted to really invest in digital design and optimization tools. And so we had this digital design path going. And then in parallel, we started building hardware. And that was really about getting calibration data for all the digital stuff. So along the way, we tested probably thousands of samples of carbon fiber composites and different ways to put it together, different ways to make a joint, ranges of temperatures. We started doing wind tunnel testing. And all of that sort of data out of the world of atoms fed back into the world of bits so that our digital design tools could just get better and better and better. And that we could iterate much faster than we could kind of, you know, just building airplanes and throwing them away.
Let's talk about actually, because you have a prototype. And I think in October of 2020, you unveiled your first fully assembled prototype, the XB-1. It's a smaller version of what you will eventually produce. But I mean, how is there like how do you build that? I mean, do you guys have a warehouse that you, you know, you get component parts and you start to assemble it, or is it built for you in another place? And are you directing them? Like, who builds a supersonic aircraft prototype?
So we put it all together ourselves. One of the things that makes this business possible is that the aerospace supply chain is pretty mature. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just to put this in context, this is the first independently developed supersonic jet ever. Like, previously it's been governments and military. So we were first to say, hey, we're going to go do this. And we designed the whole airplane. And then to get it built, we teamed with suppliers to build components. And then we brought it all to our facility in Denver where we put it together. And so we have this, you know, roughly 50,000 square foot building that's in a part offices, part hangar. It was a supersonic jet factory. That's where we built the XB-1, where we put it together ourselves.
Well, we're going to take another quick break, but we'll hear more from Blake Scholl, founder and CEO of Boom Supersonic, in just a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This Lab. In U.S. working forests, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com. Audible is the home of storytelling, and it lets you enjoy all of your audio entertainment in one app. You'll always find the best of what you love or something new to discover. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. In fact, I've been really into thrillers and true crime lately, and I just got back from a long car trip where I was listening to the latest zombie Fallout book, Bridging the Gap. And I swear, I had to keep checking the back seat for any glowing eyes as I drove home on that deserted highway. In fact, on so many of my journeys, Audible is there for me with comedy, bestsellers, history, exclusive originals, and more. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/built or text built to 500-500. That's audible.com/built or text built to 500-500. Welcome back to How I Built This Lab. My guest is Blake Scholl, whose company Boom Supersonic is looking to build a new generation of supersonic airplanes for commercial travel. All right, let's talk about this prototype, because I know that you wanted to begin test flights in 2021, but it hasn't happened yet. This has not been through a test flight. What are the obstacles and hurdles that have prevented that prototype from flying?
So where we are today is just a few months away from flying this bird. We finished late last year our final Denver-based taxi test. Mm-hmm. And we've got a couple of things where we want to add some safety margin to the airplane, and then we're going to take it down to the Mojave Desert for flight test probably around the middle of this year. So, but you know, what you said is that this thing has taken a lot longer than we thought it would. And I think that's a combination of a few factors. You know, one was, quite honestly, some naivete on my part. Like, I underestimated how hard this was. And maybe I had to in order to decide to go do it.
Right. I think so,
but
yeah.
For better or worse, I thought this was easier than it actually was. And so we said, you know, we were sort of perennially optimistic about time frame. You know, and then we've learned some things along the way. And, you know, one of the big thematic learnings was, you know, we chose to build a human-piloted aircraft. This is not a drone. And, you know, we know the test pilots who are going to go fly it. And it's an extraordinarily complex machine. It's a new design airplane. The design's different from anything that's ever flown before. And so it's really important that it be right, because it's life and death serious. And so many times along the way, we've had the opportunity to say, hey, is this good enough? Or do we think it needs to be better? And so we've tested everything as we went along. And when we found opportunities to improve the safety profile of the airplane, we've done it. You know, and then the other kind of dimension to it is, like, we've been learning along the way. We you know, if you sort of imagine, hey, it's a new company, first new commercial aircraft company a century. We're going to build a 65-passenger supersonic airliner that weighs several hundred thousand pounds, and trust us, we'll get it right the first time. Like, I don't even believe that.
Yeah.
And so we did XB1 because we knew we would make mistakes, and we wanted to make the mistakes on a small, simpler airplane before we went and did the big airplane, because those learnings would be what would enable the big airplane overture to be a success. And so,
right.
Yeah, we've made mistakes along the way, and that's a good thing because we've learned.
Yeah, and the XB1, just to clarify, is the prototype. Overture is going to be the commercially developed plane that you'll eventually make, and I guess the XB1 is like a third the size of the Overture. I'm looking at a model of the Overture on your website. It's a beautiful plane. It's got four engines, and it's a small plane, obviously. So how will Overture compare to the last commercial supersonic airplane, which, you know, of course, as we've said, was the Concorde?
So the size is relatively similar to Concorde from a kind of total weight of the airplane, but it's got a lot more range and it's got a lot better passenger comfort. Overture puts 65 passengers where Concorde put 100. Mm-hmm. So on board the airplane, it's a lot more spacious, a lot more comfortable. We really want to build something that people are going to want to fly over and over again.
Yeah.
And Concorde, a lot of problems, but one of them was it wasn't affordable to very many people. A ticket had to be around $20,000. And you just can't find 100 people who want to pay 20 grand to go somewhere on very many routes. And so we said, look, ultimately we want to make supersonic flight available to everybody who flies. You know, we want flying fast to be less expensive than flying slow. That's the big driver. And then for Overture 1, we've said, look, we want to focus on business class.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've designed that airplane such that it will be profitable for airlines at fares a quarter of what was charged on Concorde.
So it'd be about $5,000.
At $5,000, it is on most routes, it is very profitable for airlines.
And that's basically equivalent to a business class flight from London to New York, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the fares vary, but it's pretty common for people to pay $5,000 or, you know, sometimes more than that for a round trip ticket across the Atlantic. So,
yeah.
You know, so $5,000 for supersonic, most business travelers I talk to are like, wow, that actually seems like a good deal.
All right, let's talk about range for a moment. I mean, the Concorde flew Paris, New York, and London, New York by the end of its life cycle, mainly. That was its route. Is this a plane that could fly Los Angeles to Hong Kong or San Francisco to Tokyo?
So it has about 4,250 nautical miles of range. And so what that means in practice is that just about the longest nonstop route would be Tokyo to Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
In 4.5 hours. And just pause on that for a second. 4.5 hours across the Pacific.
Now it takes, what, 10?
Yeah, roughly, you know, 9, 10. It depends which direction we're going, what the winds are, et cetera. But yeah, like roughly twice that. And you know, that's fast enough that you can leave the U.S. a whole day later to make a given meeting in Tokyo. It's just like much, much faster. One of the things I think will be really interesting is how the airplane gets used on longer routes. Let's take a really painful example, like LA to Sydney, which
yeah.
is like 15, 16 hours today. Well, Overture can't do that nonstop. It has to stop for gas.
Right.
But even with the pit stop, it's going to be like 8.5 hours.
Right.
So you're on the ground for maybe 25, 30 minutes, something like that. And then you're back up and away. And the refuel has, you know, it's the experiential equivalent of a little bit of turbulence in the middle of the flight because it's yeah. not interruptive to the experience.
All right. And now let's talk about the environmental side to it, because you're talking about using sustainable aviation fuels. Tell me how this is going to, because you have a plan to be carbon neutral. So how do you make this flight substantially better than existing commercial flights?
Let's start with why. And it goes back to kind of what makes me get out of bed every morning. And you know, I deeply believe that life happens in person, that more time spent in the same room with other people around the planet is not just good for business. It's not just good for, you know, being able to fall in love with somebody from any continent. It's going to be deeply transformative for cross-cultural understanding. You know, what happens when our kids grow up having spent time with people from every continent, not just kind of read about them or watch, you know, YouTube videos or whatever. So like enabling more in-person interaction matters. And so I actually believe in a future where there's a lot more travel than there is today. And that your speed and affordability and convenience are the big drivers of making it possible to travel more than we do today. So that brings us to sustainability, because there are, you know, there are real concerns. Today, aviation is about 2-2.5% of global carbon emissions. But if we, you know, if we like 10 times the travel, like, wow, we took a thing that we already needed to make smaller, we made it a lot bigger. And so it's not good enough, in my view, to just sort of optimize, focus on efficiency, kind of chip away a few percent at a time. We need to find a way to go all the way to carbon neutral so that climate impacts are not a reason for people to avoid traveling. Okay, so how do you do that? You know, it's not batteries, because batteries are just far too heavy.
Yeah.
So you want the energy density of liquid hydrocarbons. But the exciting thing is they don't have to be sourced out of fossil fuels out of the ground. But there's sort of a new generation of fuel technology that's called power to liquid. Mm-hmm. That is basically a carbon sequestration-based technology that you can use to create synthetic kerosene. And this stuff, it actually exists. It's scaling really rapidly. It's still early, but it's scaling really well. And then that technology, you know, because it's effectively powered out of atmospheric carbon, it can go all the way to net zero. And so this is what I think ultimately every long-haul airplane is going to do. This is the way we decarbonize long-haul air travel. One of the nice things about sustainable aviation fuel is it's backwards compatible, meaning it's chemically very similar to traditional fossil jet fuel. Mm-hmm. And so today's airplanes can do 50-50 of sustainable fuel and traditional fuel. Overture can do 100%. But the fact that there's some backwards compatibility here makes it far simpler to deploy. So every time we put sustainable aviation fuel in an airport, the climate story out of that airport gets better. So yeah, Overture is designed around sustainable aviation fuel. It's the first airliner that can accept 100% sustainable aviation fuel, not just blended down to 50-50. And for that reason, it can get all the way to net zero. And this is important to us. It's important to our customers. You know, when United Airlines ordered Overture, they made a public commitment to run it on 100% sustainable aviation fuel on a net zero carbon basis. And I find it personally just really exciting that the airplane that we all most want to fly on is also going to be the best one for the planet.
All right. So one of the main criticisms of supersonic air travel, as you know, is the noise, right? We've all heard of a sonic boom, right? It's this extremely loud sound that a jet makes when it breaks a sound barrier. And I think it's why Concorde was limited to flying out of just a few airports by the end of its life. And it only flew at supersonic speeds over the ocean, right? So let's talk about the routes that you're hoping Overture will fly. I mean, if you're going west from the U.S., you got to fly out of LAX and Seattle. You mentioned San Francisco. You want to fly out of New York because New York, London, New York, Paris is a profitable route. And I know that you've partnered with United, and obviously Chicago, Denver are huge hubs for United. Are you going to have to make the case to city by city that you know, that these airports should allow these planes to take off and land from their locations?
So this meets the same most stringent noise standards that apply to latest generation subsonic airplanes.
Got it.
So long as we meet environmental noise standards and safety standards, you know, the airplane is sort of automatically allowed everywhere, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be. It operates with existing infrastructure. You know, the rule of thumb is if you can operate a 777, you can operate an Overture from a runway perspective.
Right.
So when the supersonic service comes to a local airport, the community can be really excited about the new capability, not like nervous that, like, you know, they're going to be disturbed. And I think that's super, super important to get right. And what that means is that there are hundreds of routes around the planet that can accept Overture. And it's, you know, it's not going to create new noise impacts for airport communities.
All right. So you are now, you've just announced that you're going to build a plant in North Carolina to build the Overture planes. First, you've got to test the XB1. And I know that the hope is to test it in 2023. And you've got a bunch of orders from United and American, I think, and Japan Airlines and a couple other, you know, airlines. When do you think, let's say, estimate, when will the Overture aircraft start coming off the assembly line?
Yeah. So one thing to understand is, you know, we've learned everything we need to learn from XP1 to go make Overture a reality. And so we have to do sort of a demonstration that airplane works. But frankly, most of the team is working on Overture now, and we're full speed ahead.
Got it. Okay.
So we're breaking ground on the plant to build it. And we will be in production by the end of 24. We'll have the first airplane in 26, and we'll start flight testing it in 27.
You'll have the first Overture in 2026. That's the plan.
That's right. And our goal is to spend 2 years in that flight test campaign and then be certified to carry passengers by the end of 2029.
Got it. This is a really challenging, hard project that you've taken on. You started this essentially in 2014, and hopefully by 2029, these planes will be available for people to travel on. I mean, it's of course in sort of the history of aviation, this is not a long time period, but it is long. It's not like your other startups that, you know, you build an app and 6 months later it's out in the world. I mean, this is a long, hard slog.
You know, it is a long process. It's challenging in a whole bunch of different ways. Success is not guaranteed by any stretch, but I don't experience that as a slog personally, because I deeply believe that restarting innovation in flight, and in particular making the planet more accessible, is an incredibly important thing to do. Along the way, I get to work with the best team I've ever worked with before, and I get to come to work in a supersonic jet factory.
Yeah.
Like, it's just cool and fun along the way. And, you know, I can look forward and say, like, you know, man, we're, you know, there's a lot of capital we need. There's a lot of technical and engineering work that has to happen. We have to make sure that we build this in a way that's incredibly safe for the flying public. And so there's, you know, there's a lot of challenge that's still ahead of us. But I kind of look in the mirror, in the rearview mirror, and say, you know what? We've already built history's first independently developed supersonic jet. We've already gotten major airlines to place orders and make non-refundable deposits. There's a lot that we've already done that people said that we could never do.
Yeah.
And so we just need to keep doing things that people said we could never do.
Amazing. Blake Scholl, thanks so much.
Thank you, Guy. I really appreciate the conversation.
That's Blake Scholl, founder and CEO of Boom Supersonic. Thanks so much for listening to How I Built This Lab. Please do follow us on your podcast app so you always have the latest episode downloaded. If you want to follow us on Twitter, our account is at How I Built This, and mine is at Guy Raz. And on Instagram, I'm at guy.raz. If you want to contact the team, our email address is hibt@id.wondery.com. This episode was produced by Chris Messini, with editing by John Isabella. Our audio engineer was James Willits. Our music was composed by Ramtin Arablouei. Our production team at How I Built This includes Alex Chung, Carla Estevez, Casey Herman, JC Howard, Liz Metzger, Sam Paulson, Carrie Thompson, and Elaine Coates. Neva Grant is our supervising editor. Beth Donovan is our executive producer. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. If you like How I Built This, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman, from Wondery. Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in our newest season, we track the power struggles within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it all says about the future and safety of artificial intelligence. Make sure to follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dives and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, Business Wars, and many more. Let me tell you, Wondery means business.